Welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. And I'm delighted and honored to have as my guest today, Alan Lightman. We'll be discussing Mr. Lightman's new book, Ghost, which has been recently published by Pantheon Books. And first of all, Alan, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on your program.
For those that are aware of your work, we will be discussing Ghost here in a moment. For those that are new to the world of Alan Lightman, let's give them a little bit of a sense of where you have come from prior to publishing Ghost, which I thoroughly enjoyed. And I would also like to recommend to listeners that they go out and buy a copy of Sense of the Mysterious that was recently published by Pantheon in 2005. Because after I read that book, I read A Sense of the Mysterious, then read Ghost, then went back and read the essays again, and it kind of gave me a little more feel, I think, for what you try to achieve in your fiction. And if you would you talk a little bit about the essay in A Sense of the Mysterious, the title essay?
Well, this is an autobiographical essay. I think every writer can write one autobiographical essay, and really he or she shouldn't write more than one.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an essay that traces my really emotional and intellectual history, starting from an early age when I was interested in both the arts and the sciences, and how I navigated through a life and really a dual career in both the arts and the sciences as a novelist and as a physicist. And of course there are a lot of tensions between the arts and the science. I think positive tensions, but nonetheless they represent two different ways of being in the world, of experiencing the world, two different kinds of truth. And I think society pushes us to be one kind of person or the other, either the intuitive, artistic type of person or the rational, scientific kind of person. In our set of friends, in our careers, and the way in our personalities, and it's difficult to make a life in both. And I describe some of my difficulties in the essay, and also some of my pleasures.
And in the essay, A Sense of the Mysterious, you talk about, and I found this fascinating, that science really was a younger person's game. And you kind of made a conscious decision when you were in your youth to pursue the science side of your creativity first, with the kind of conscious intention that you would write and pursue your artistic pursuits as kind of the second phase of your career.
Yes. Well, it wasn't quite as conscious as it may seem in the essay. I mean, when you're 21 years old and you just graduated from college and you're trying to decide what are you going to do now with your life, you don't really know much about the world at that point. And you might have some instincts and some intuitions, but you really are fairly innocent and ignorant. And I did have a sense that I knew of some scientists who had later become writers in their lives, but I didn't know of any writers who later in life became scientists.
Mm-hmm.
So I had the sense that it would be better to start my career putting most of my time into science. But I didn't understand the reason for that. It was just a sort of a gut instinct.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. And, Alan, when I went back and reread the essay after reading Ghost, I really could see some of the tie-ins with what I think we were working on in Ghost. And as we discuss Ghost, it seemed to me that you mentioned Joseph Weber in your essay. And it seemed like, as I read Ghost, that he kind of had a little bit of a resonance in this novel.
Well, Joseph Weber was a distinguished American physicist, spent most of his career, I believe, at the University and he was an experimenter, and his great accomplishment, well, one of his great accomplishments was that he was a pioneer in building equipment to detect gravitational waves, which are like light waves, except they're gravity waves. His work was later discredited, but some of his design ideas became incorporated into the modern gravitational wave detectors. Sort of mocked him in the 1980s in one of my essays, and I realized later that I was very wrong to mock him because he had had great vision, even though his particular detectors and equipment had were flawed. But I'm not sure where he fits into the novel Ghost.
Right.
Maybe you can tell me what character.
Well, I think what happened is, and let's move on to Ghost, which has recently been published by Pantheon Books, and it seems to me that. That when you discuss and you write about the exact nature of science and what drew you to equations and physics and astronomy, you know, the clarity of that, and then kind of the more unstructured nature of the arts, let's talk about David Kurzweil, and the first line in the first sentence in Ghost is, "I saw something," which is probably the most direct sentence in the book, and I really like the way you opened the novel with that.
Mm-hmm. Well, David Kurzweil, my protagonist, is a man in his early 40s who he's been worked in a bank most of his career. He's intelligent, but he's not ambitious. His only ambition is really to understand more about the world. He's intellectually curious. He reads a tremendous amount. When the novel opens, he's been divorced for a number of years. He has a girlfriend. He has just been fired from his job at the bank for no reason at all that he can discern. The great irony of that is that he's a person who believes very strongly in cause and effect relations. He's a rationalist. He thinks that everything that happens in the world has a reason. He's a materialist. He believes that the world is all material. He doesn't believe in God. He doesn't believe in supernatural. So the first strange thing that happens is he's fired from the bank for no reason, and then later on he takes a temporary job in a mortuary, and he considers it only temporary. And there one afternoon, sitting alone with a casket and a person in the casket, a dead body, he thinks that he sees something supernatural, and he's really pretty much unable to articulate what he sees. I think two-thirds of the way into the novel, after 200 pages, is the first time he's able to make an attempt at describing what he sees, and he says that it was, because it happened only once, he had his vision only once, but he describes it as some kind of vapor that came out of the body, or maybe went into the body, he's not sure, but it had intelligence, and it looked at him. That's all I can say about it. Other people call this apparition, and when he tells them about it, they call it a ghost. He never uses the word ghost. And when people hear about his sort of metaphysical experience, some people believe him and some people don't. And he, in his own mind, has a terrible struggle trying to make sense of this vision that he saw, and it challenges everything he believes in, his belief that the world is rational, that it's all material, it's all matter, there's no soul, there's no heaven, there's no supernatural. This experience that he has throws him into a terrible panic, and he questions it and tries to repeat the experience, and I think for me, most of the novel is about his inner struggle with trying to come to terms with this experience that suggests that there's a transcendent world, that there's another spiritual world out there that's not scientific, it's not subject to science, it doesn't follow the rules of the scientific world. And all of his relationships with people change as a result of the experience. His relationship with his ex-wife, his girlfriend, his mother, his employer, they change because he's been changed by the experience, and so all of his relationships with people begin changing.
Mm-hmm. In fact, Ellen, his girlfriend, that's really when she feels like he wants her to believe that he has seen a ghost, and she can't force herself to go in that direction. I think maybe when what with Joseph Weber resonated with me was the R box and the testing that goes on.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And
yes.
There's
a paranormal society that gets wind of David's sighting because there's a story about it in the newspaper, and they want to test his psychic powers, and they have various experimental apparatus that they use to test his psychic powers. And the people, there's some scientists at a university where he lives, and they are adamantly opposed to any suggestion that the supernatural exists, and they want to do their experiments, and they categorically dismiss the possibility of the supernatural. And the experiments that the various groups do, some of which are public, have ambiguous results. That is, results can be interpreted either that he does have psychic powers or that he doesn't. And everybody goes home at the end of the day sort of believing what they did initially. They're not swayed to change their mind by the evidence, either if they believe in the supernatural or if they reject it. And underneath all of this confusion and debate and argument and emotional belief, there is David's own inner struggle with trying to accept the spiritual world, questioning it, trying to accept it, trying to understand whether it really is true. He won't renounce his experience, his vision, even though the scientists want him to publicly denounce it and renounce it and reject it. He can't do that because he believes what he saw.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things I like about Ghost, Alan, is that you really, it's very well balanced, I felt. Another essay you wrote in A Sense of the Mysterious is called Prisoner of the Wired World.
Mm-hmm.
And there's kind of this tension between technology and the need to prove things, and then also the sense of the mysterious and the importance of not understanding exactly what happens. And it seems like these two things play off against themselves in Ghost.
Yes, that's right. There are things that we understand and things we don't understand, and there are questions that have answers and there are questions without answers. And you know, very, very crudely, although I'm greatly simplifying, science is an enterprise which asks questions that have answers, and the humanities and the arts often ask questions that don't have answers. And I think that is really at the heart of David's struggle and Ghost. Can he accept a world that is not material, a world that doesn't obey logic and cause and effect relations, a world that's not approachable by science? Can he accept that? And he has a tremendous struggle with that. And I think that he's, you know, still struggling at the end of the book.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm fascinated by the fact that a large fraction of the American public believes in miracles and heaven and survival of the soul after death, no matter how much science advances and is able to put more and more phenomena on a scientific basis. There is still persistent because mm-hmm. I think scientists are bigoted in their own way, just as spiritualists are. I mean, I subscribe more to the scientific view myself,
mm-hmm.
but I think that the scientists are very reluctant to give up their own beliefs. That evidently these two ways of understanding the world and being in the world, either belief that everything's material or the other belief that there's a non-material world that's alongside the material world, those two beliefs seem to be two different ways of looking at the world that are very visceral, very emotional, very deeply rooted, impervious to argument one way or the other. And I just think that's amazing and interesting to
mm-hmm.
me.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things I like about Ghost is I like novels that challenge me, that don't really tell me what I have to think. And in A Sense of the Mysterious, you wrote, good characters must retain a certain mystery and unfathomable depth, even for the author. Once we see to the bottom of their hearts, the novel is dead for us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that David is a very good example of that kind of a character.
Yes. Yeah, we don't. Well, he never comes to any definitive conclusions or resolutions, and I think at the, you know, when we get to the very last page of the book, that we're still not sure whether he saw something or only imagined it. I'm not, there will be readers who believe what he saw, and there are readers who think that he imagined it. And,
mm-hmm.
But I think that within the text itself, you know, minus the interpretation of the reader, that it can be argued either way, that there is no conclusive resolution to his experience.
Yes. And he asks himself on more than one occasion, if something only happens once to you in your life, did it really happen?
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm 50 years old now, and I've lived enough life where I can look back and I can ask that question myself.
Yes. Yes, I know it's a perplexing question, and the memory is plays tricks on us all the time. Our memory is flexible and malleable, and we often distort it to recast reality the way that we want to. The world is a very strange place, and even though I believe the world is subject to cause and effect relationships, and there are laws of nature that make predictions, there still is quite a lot of it's a strange experience, just consciousness and existence.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not surprising that there are a wide variety of strategies, of psychological strategies, by which people try to make a place for their mental world, their mental life. Do you believe in the supernatural or don't you? Some people feel that they gain more comfort and peace by believing in God and believing in miracles and believing in a supernatural, believing in an invisible world that we can influence by our prayer and ritual. And there are other people that believe that we gain more peace and comfort and control by rejecting all of that, by saying that everything is material, that everything obeys definite cause and effect relationships, that there is no life after the physical death of the body. And both kinds of belief, I think, are motivated by a desire to bring control of this strange world around us, a sense of inner peace. And it's a great irony that both these groups of people, which I think covers everybody, are trying to achieve the same thing, that is some kind of peace, of harmony with the world around them, and yet they adapt very different strategies for achieving that, either belief in the supernatural and everything that comes with it, or rejection of that.
Mm-hmm. And I love on page 181 of Ghost, Albert Einstein weighs in and says, the most beautiful experience we can have is the mysterious. It is the fundamental emotion which stands at the cradle of true art and true science. So I love the way you bring Einstein in at that point in the book to kind of share both sides of the story, almost.
Yeah. Well, that's one of David, my hero, and grappling with his experience, and because he's a great book reader, reads lots of great thinkers and writers to try to see what their opinion is on the supernatural. And this quote by Einstein, which is an actual true quote, is the closest, you know, one of the closest points in which Einstein addressed the question, but he calls it the mysterious. And again, that's subject to interpretation. Did Einstein mean by mysterious something that's supernatural? Did he mean something that we can never comprehend? I think that what he meant by that is awe at what we don't yet know. Mm-hmm. That we can stand at the boundary of what we know and what we don't know, and instead of being frightened by standing at that boundary, we feel a sense of awe.
That's fascinating. And Alan, before I let you go, I want to discuss for a moment Einstein's Dreams, which I mentioned briefly when we visited earlier, is one of my favorite books that I read over and over again. And the Einstein's Dreams was published in 1993, still available in vintage books, as are Reunion and The Diagnosis, which was a finalist for the National Book Award in 2000. When you sat down to write Einstein's Dreams, the format and the style of the book are very different and very creative. How long was that floating around in your head before you were able to write those amazing passages down on paper?
Well, I mean, there's the format and the style of language, and then there's the idea of the book. The idea of the book came to me in the form of the title. And I don't know where ideas and words come from. You know, you're just very grateful to the muses when you get a good idea. Most of my ideas are bad ideas, but fortunately a few of them are good ideas. But the title, the two words Einstein and Dreams came to me first. That was the beginning of the book. And they sort of represented this tension between the scientific and the artistic, or the rational and intuitive that we were talking about earlier. The structure of the book, I think that I was influenced by Italo Calvino's little book, Invisible Cities, in which there are short chapters in which a fictitious Marco Polo is reporting to a fictitious Genghis Khan about the cities that lie in Khan's empire. And the interludes that are in Einstein's Dreams that are interspersed between the dream sequences, I put in so that the book would have a narrative glue. So it would feel like not a set of poems, but a whole narrative that has a beginning, middle, and end. So that's the cadences and rhythms in the sentences come from my love of poetry, and poetry was actually the first writing that I did when I was 8 or 9 years old. I began writing poems, and I've always loved poems, and I think poetry is very good training for any novelist to learn to listen to the sounds and the cadences of words. So that dimension of the book, the cadences, rhythms, and poetic images in the book were already in me from a young age.
Did you read the manuscript out loud as you were writing it?
Oh yes, I do that for all of my writing, all of my fiction writing. I read the sentences out loud.
Yeah, I had that. Your writing has that poetical prose to it that I kind of assumed that you did that.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing about Einstein's dreams is I love the illustrations.
Oh, well, thank you. I love the illustrations too, and I haven't kept up with the man who did them. I wanted illustrations of pen and ink drawings that had a quaintness and a classical feel to them, and I really was very lucky to stumble upon this illustrator who I'd seen some of his earlier work, was able to hire him to do this.
That's fabulous. And Alan, Albert Einstein has had a resurgence of popularity over the last 15 or 20 years. And what is it that you think is at the core of, I mean, when you see celebrities, I guess, and how much money they make since they've died, Albert Einstein is always, you know, up near the top. And what is it, do you think, you probably get talked to about Albert Einstein as much as anybody, what do you think people's fascination with Albert Einstein
continues to be? Well, let me just say, first of all, that I think the amount of money that a person makes has no correlation, little correlation to their contribution.
I agree.
So I just want to clarify my own opinion about that.
Yes.
Whether Einstein's estate has made a lot of money or not has nothing to do with his cultural importance.
But exactly.
Getting to your deeper question, which I respect and would like to respond to, I think that in the scientific world, that Einstein is considered to be the greatest scientist since Isaac Newton. So he's someone who doesn't just come along every 20 or 30 years or even every century. He's someone who comes along every few centuries.
Mm-hmm.
For the general public, I think that that one of the reasons why he is such an iconic figure is that the public knows that he did something profound with time and space, and although very few of the public know exactly what he did and know what the equations were, they do have a gut feeling of what time and space mean, and they can understand that it must have been something very profound to alter our concept of time and space. And then Einstein came along during World War One, when the world had just had its one of its greatest, its most terrible wars, and everyone was tired of the inhumanity in people evidenced by warfare. And in 1919, right after World War One was over, there was a very famous experiment that confirmed one of Einstein's theories. And here was a man who was a pacifist, who had denounced war, who was a gentle person, who was a pure thinker, and his theory of gravity had just been confirmed by experiment, or one of its critical predictions had been verified, I should put it that way. And so he sort of represented hope for humanity,
mm-hmm.
that there was a good side of humanity, a pure side, a side that was
Well, thank you for answering that, because I've been wanting to ask you that since 1993 when I read Einstein's Dreams. And Alan, I want to thank you so much for taking time out of a busy schedule to talk with us today, and I'd like to congratulate you on Ghost, and also recommend that everyone really just that hasn't discovered your work read the essays and the novels, and thank you for continuing to write these fabulous novels.
Well, thank you, Casey. It's been a pleasure being on your program, and I very much appreciate your interest in my work.
Great. Well, we will catch up with you when the next book comes out.
Okay.
Okay. Take care.
Bye.